This episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show is brought to you by Nissan. Nissan SUVs have the capabilities to take your adventure to the next level. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
Coming up next on the Jordan Harbinger Show.
I was leaving Iraq. I made it to Qatar. The unit commander contacted me. He's like, hey, there is a hostage situation and a kidnapped soldier in Iraq. We need you to go back. So I had to call my wife and say, hey, I'm sorry, I'm not coming. I have to go back. And those are the things that a lot of people don't realize. So people are like, oh, military guys are really cool and they deploy and like special operation guys and they get paid more and they jump out of aircraft. And to call your wife the day you're supposed to arrive back home and you tell her you're not coming, dude.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. On the Jordan Harbinger Show, we decode the stories, secrets, and skills of the world's most fascinating people and turn their wisdom into practical advice that you can use to impact your own life and those around you. Our mission is to help you become a better informed, more critical thinker through long-form conversations with a variety of amazing folks, from spies to CEOs, athletes, authors, thinkers, performers, even the occasional organized crime figure, drug trafficker, cold case homicide investigator, real-life pirate, or extreme athlete. And if you're new to the show or you're looking for a handy way to tell your friends about the show, I suggest our episode starter packs. These are collections of our favorite episodes on persuasion and negotiation, psychology, geopolitics, disinformation, cyber warfare, AI, crime and cults, and more. It'll help new listeners get a taste of everything we do here on the show. Just visit jordanharbinger.com/start or search for us in your Spotify app to get started. My guest today, Adam Gamal, is a former member of The Unit. The Unit is a Tier 1 special mission unit where intelligence and special operations meet. The unit has another name, but we're not allowed to know what it is. We're also not allowed to know Adam's real name, what his face looks like, nor meet him in person to do this interview. So there's quite a bit under wraps here. This conversation, it is quite a tale. Adam moved to the United States from Egypt at the age of 20, speaking virtually no English, and went on to infiltrate terror organizations, collect intelligence, interrogate detainees, catch and kill high-value targets, and a whole lot more. We cover terrorism, special military operations, and intelligence gathering, as well as some fun stories about Adam's travels. You can only imagine where this guy has been and what places shine in this industry, if you can call it that. He's also great at telling his ridiculous story of immigration to the United States. It's quite humorous. Adam was very generous with his time, and as you'd expect from any special forces operator, a true patriot in so many ways. I think you're going to love this conversation. Even if you're not into the military hoorah stuff, there's just so much here to chew on. And FYI, there's some F-bombs in this one that we didn't bleep, so if you're offended by that, well, you might want to skip this one. Now here we go with Adam Gamal. When we talked on the phone, I was like, okay, it's like a military guy, has been through some stuff or whatever, but then it was, the more I looked at it, the more it really is kind of a unique story that we'll get into, I'm sure. But first of all, early in the book, you're talking about calling in an airstrike on, I think it was an Al-Qaeda terrorist in Somalia. It's like, well, there's a mosque on site, so we can't do an airstrike. What's the deal with that? Can't you see if a mosque is empty? Is it just you can't blow up a mosque? What's the rule there?
So it was basically, at that time, U.S. government rules. For us, we had rules of engagement. According to Geneva Convention, according to international law, and according to our own U.S. constitutions and whatever the government puts in place. At that time, it was, if we're going to have a strike on a mosque, it needed presidential approval. So we would have to take the mission, but we used to call it like target package. So we would take the target package to through Secretary of Defense all the way to the president. The president would have to approve it, say yes or no. But what I was trying to explain to people, the definition of a mosque is different. Guys have like a room in their house they pray at. They have like a corner of in their backyard they pray at. We wouldn't call that a mosque. So for people who didn't understand the culture, they would go and say, well, they pray in there. It must be a mosque. But to go back to your question too, not all the time you can have, you cannot see what's inside the mosque or inside the room. So sometimes we go on target based on what we can see and sometimes what we cannot see, but we have our own ways of knowing what's inside, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I just wonder, why don't bad guys just hide in mosques most of the time if it's harder to strike a mosque? I mean, wouldn't that just sort of make it so that if they're a target of opportunity, they can get away most of the time because they know that, oh, well, it's going to take them at least a couple hours to get approval, by which point I'll be gone, or they might not bother at all.
Yeah, but they cannot live inside the mosque. They can't be there 24/7. And when we were tracking guys, like, for example, that guy, But we're tracking him 24/7, like where he sleeps, where he goes to eat, where he's at. At that time, it was the best time to minimize collateral damage was in the super early hours of the morning, like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, that guy was doing his morning prayer. So it was, we had to balance. I had to balance between taking a guy out in the middle of the day where you have a lot more collateral damage, or taking him at night, right after he finishes his morning prayer or right before he goes to his morning prayer. We just needed to understand that I needed to explain to people the definition of a mosque. So a mosque is like a church. But if you go to the side of your house and you decide to pray, that doesn't make, if you have a bedroom or like a, let's say a meditation room, and you make it a prayer room, that does not make your prayer room a church or a mosque. So that's what we were trying to work on. But yeah, guys cannot hide in a mosque or in a church or in a synagogue 24/7. They have to come out.
Yeah, of course. That completely makes sense. It's just, it's an interesting story in that, one, that the rules of engagement seem to hinder a lot of the anti-terror stuff that we're doing. And I appreciate that they're trying to avoid just making more terrorists by blowing up mosques all the time. That seems like a wise strategy. However, it was also interesting to me that at this point in time, you're an Egyptian guy who's an American at this point, right? And you're fighting terrorism and you're in the position of explaining what a mosque is to people. It's like, wow, we really are starting from anti-terror 101 over here. Like, this is what a mosque is and is not. That just shows you how far behind the learning curve we were at the time.
To give you a good, like, anecdote of this, and 2 years before that, I called one of the military intelligence branches that they train, like, for interrogators. And I called the guy, and I put it in the book, and I called the guy, and I wanted to change my job to be an interrogator. And he's like, what language? And I said, Arabic. And he's like, we don't have any need for Arabic. And I was like, I'm a native Arabic speaker. You don't have to send me to school to learn Arabic. When we send guys to Defense Language Institute in California, DLI, for Arabic, we send them for over 54 or 55 weeks, so over a year. And then when they come out of there, they're not proficient at the language at that level, operational level yet. So I'm going to save them like hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, time and everything. And the guy was like, well, but really, we don't need any Arabic speakers. So I was like, well, if you don't need any Arabic speakers, I don't know what to tell you. But that was like literally 2 years before 9/11, but it was 6 years after the first World Trade Center. And it was 2 years after the embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. So we were seeing radicals and we were seeing like terrorism and terrorist attacks, but we still couldn't grasp. So when you go and you explain to people, like, you're absolutely right. When you go and explain it to people, what's a mosque? What definition is of a mosque? Without burning the book to your listeners, Bin Laden was not the first guy who got buried at sea. Again, the first guy got buried at sea was in Africa, and it was me and a State Department person saying, okay, if a Muslim guy got killed and he's taken into a back of a ship, what do we do? Do we give the body back? What do we do? So those things that, you're absolutely right. Without having the cultural understanding, you're right, we're way, way behind.
You know, that mirrors my experience perfectly with the whole language learning thing. I joined the Marine Reserves in college, and one of the commanding officers, I went in and I said, hey, I can't make my Russian and Arabic classes because I have to march in a field, and I need permission to stop this marching in a field thing because I can't attend either Russian or Arabic classes during that time. And that's the only time they offer the class. And he's like, well, you've got to make your schedule around us, not the other way around. And I'm like, but I'm taking Russian and Arabic. And he was like, we don't need languages, pal. We need nuclear engineers. And I was like, are you kidding me? One, I'm not an engineer. So I'm not even in engineering school at the time. And I was just thinking, this is just wrong. It's blatantly wrong. The president of the United States at the time, George Bush, was talking about how we needed all these language learners. And I was like, do you just not watch the news? I mean, what's going on here? And it just showed me how kind of the military is so far even behind other elements in the government, at least this level of the military, that it was just brain dead, that you wouldn't want somebody to be learning both Russian and Arabic. But instead, you know, we really need you marching in this field at 9 a.m. every day. You can't take two of these mandated required languages that the Defense Department has put on a website saying we need more of. It was just mind-blowing.
Yeah, absolutely right. To add to this, you know what's a PMCS? So it's primary military check something. It's like basically where you go to the motor pool to check if the vehicle works properly or not. I don't remember because I've been out for a while what PMCS stands for, but it's something that military units, they do every week where they send soldiers to the motor pool to check their vehicles.
Preventative maintenance checks and services.
That's it. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So before 9/11, I went to the FBI for a temporary duty for 3 months. And part of it was to translate the Al-Qaeda manual, that which we had for a few years at that time. I had good contacts at the FBI, and there was like a deal between an agreement between the FBI and DOD. They can borrow linguists. So I called the FBI that I worked with during the USS Cole bombing and the Al-Qaeda manual translation. And I told the lady at that time, I said, hey, we have about 7-8 Arabic speakers in the unit. I was in Fort Bragg at that time. Now they call it Fort Liberty. We're not doing anything other than going to the motor pool to check, to do the preventive maintenance on our vehicles.
Yeah.
And she's like, yeah, but we cannot ask DOD. So I go to the unit command and I'm like, we can send guys. If it's time for us to deploy, we'll bring him back to a week before and then we deploy. It's not like we're going to wake up overnight and say we're deploying tomorrow. And everybody said no. So we had fully qualified Arabic speakers checking the vehicle, the Martian, the jump in, all of those things to like military guys, to some military guys, were more important than your language maintenance. And I'm like, if we're doing maintenance on vehicles, why don't we do maintenance on language?
That's a really good point. Yeah, you'd think after 9/11, they were like, oh, you're a person who moves boxes in a warehouse, but you speak Arabic. Your job is changing tomorrow. Here's when your flight leaves, right? Like you're flying to this place to train in translation and interrogation. But instead it was like, well, make sure you've moved all those boxes in that warehouse with that forklift, pal. Not that that's not important. It doesn't have to get done. But it was just like, we have a critical shortage of language speakers. But this problem seems to be not just in the military. I mean, you mentioned how unprepared the FBI was for 9/11. You said you'd had the Al-Qaeda training manual for terrorists had been in the FBI's possession for literally years beforehand, and nobody had bothered to translate it because it was just like, some terrorist training manual probably says some stuff about terrorism, whatever.
Yeah, part of that was, so there was another guy sitting with me, an FBI. He was an older guy, so I'm assuming he was a contractor. So he retired, I think, from the FBI as a translator. Then they brought him back as a contractor. And he was sitting down and translating the Quran. And I was like, by the way, I can go buy a Quran in English for $20 from like Broadway, like downtown, like right around the World Trade Center. I was working in Federal One Plaza at that time, which was like 10 minutes away from the World Trade Center. Rather than the guy translating the Al-Qaeda manual, he was translating the Quran. And I'm like, just totally wrong priority. When we asked like why nobody was translating the Al-Qaeda manual before, they were like, well, it has a lot of military terms in it. So we needed people from the military to come and help. And as I stated, it was really easy for me to translate because the military part of the Al-Qaeda manual was already translated from English, from field manuals, US military field manuals. Some guy was working for Bin Laden translated that from English to Arabic. So for me, I was like, I just have to find the English version. So it really could have been done, but it's sad. Like, I'm afraid like now we're going through the same rhythm of life is good, nothing's going to happen, you know, all is well. And when we become complacent, that's when we get hit.
Yes, of course. And I think a lot of us agree with that. How long was the Al-Qaeda manual in the US's possession before it got translated? Do you know?
I don't know the exact time. If I go back and I put it in the book based on research I did at the time, but if I remember correctly, they had it like maybe for 2 years. I have to go back and look at it.
Yeah.
But it was like maybe 2 years. It was taken from an Al-Qaeda cell in, I think, Manchester, UK. They trained the guy, they found material in his house, and one of the material they had was the Al-Qaeda manual.
Yeah. Now, of course, 9/11 woke us up, but it was a pretty heavy price to pay for being so complacent. You mentioned earlier burying terrorists at sea. What is the deal with that? Because I'd never heard of burying anybody at sea, you know, on purpose, other than Bin Laden. That was kind of the first, I think most of us have ever heard of it. So what's sort of the deal with that? Is that the whole idea that there's no grave for this person? It's kind of like how I think Hitler doesn't also have a grave. You don't want people kind of going to this martyr grave and making a thing out of it. Is that the point of this?
It is partially, but it's a combination of things, actually. It's like when we go on a hit like that, whether that one we did, if we go in and to kill the guy on site and we have guys there, they take the body to make sure that they got the right person. They do DNA. But where do they do that? They take it and do it on a in the back of a ship, usually. In Somalia, that was like a Navy ship where they took the guy to do the DNA to make sure we got the right guy. And then if they give the guy back to the family, there would be a shrine, there would be all of these things. And then that would be like after doing the DNA and all of this, it was kind of like very hard. So what we did is we said, okay, let's assume the guy died at sea. So in Islam, when somebody dies at sea, what do you do? Because in Islam, when somebody dies, you bury that person within 24 hours. You're not going to keep the body for like 2-3 weeks or 2-3 months, or you're not going to put them in a fridge and none of that, right? We did the research and it was like, okay, if the guy died at sea, he gets buried at sea. And that was the burial. And then there is a prayer is done. So we brought a Muslim chaplain. The Muslim chaplain did the prayer. So we gave the guy a full Islamic service for his burial, but they get buried at sea. So the guy who got buried at sea first was not bin Laden. There was the guy who took out in Somalia.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it seems like it's probably a decent practice. Just like you said, you have to take the body. You got to get this intelligence. You don't want to be doing that on site, right? You're not going to have somebody running a DNA test in a combat zone where you just took a bunch of people out. I suppose that's wise. You bring them back to the ship, handle the business on the ship. And then do they literally just dump the body in the sea after that? Or do they cremate the body or something like that on the ship?
So it's not cremated, but they put him in a coffin. They actually do, like if you would bury somebody in land, they do the whole thing and then they just do the burial at sea. And then they drop the body at sea. Not just throw it, but the body is put in a coffin and everything. They put weights on the bottom and so it stays in the bottom of the sea.
It's not something you normally think about, but yeah, people occasionally die even of just freak accidents, right, on ships in the Navy. So there's got to be a room that's essentially a morgue with coffins, a chaplain, an undertaker of sorts, and they just handle the business. I never thought about that. If a U.S. soldier, let's say, has an accident on a boat or dies in combat, essentially, quote-unquote, at sea, do they freeze the body and bring it back to the United States, or do they don't bury those people at sea, correct?
No, they don't bury them at sea. They bring him back to the United States. So there are a couple of differences there. We couldn't give the body back to the family because it would have been a lot more process. And again, in Islam, you bury them out of respect to the death. You bury them as soon as you can, which is usually within 24 hours. And then when it's something like that, they do, like I said, when they do fly a Muslim chaplain, they fly the Muslim chaplain. He does the prayer. They fly the undertaker who knows how to clean the body before burial in within the Islamic traditions. Muslims, they wrap the body in a, you know, like a usually white coffin, like cloth. They do the wrapping, they do the cleaning, they do the whole thing. But if it's a U.S. soldier, they take him back. But this, like, it goes back to where there was no airplanes and ships used to be, like, the Titanic stayed in the sea, at sea for, like, months. So if you, back then, when people were dying at sea, you couldn't keep the body at sea for 5-6 months. So they usually, they used to, even non-Muslims, they used to bury them at sea as well. But right now, obviously, for U.S. soldiers, that the ship has all that what's needed. In addition to, you can fly an aircraft, like you can fly a helicopter to a naval ship to carry the body and take him, and then they fly him back home.
Right, yeah, that makes way more sense than anything I proposed earlier, I suppose. Yeah, right, so the Islamic tradition stuff stems from the age of empires, right? Sailboats, where it's like, oh, we're not going to be back for 3 or 6 months. We have to figure this out. We can't just keep this body on the ship. And that makes a lot of sense. Tell me about growing up. I know you started off as like a skinny kid with asthma. How do you end up in a top-level special forces unit in the United States?
You end up there by pure determination, by having grit, and by being a bit lucky. So to take you back, I started in an early age. I had an accident where I walked to the Mediterranean in January. My grandfather was visiting us. He was not visiting us. He was actually sick, and he was recovering in our house. So they left the door open of the house, and me not being a kid, like 6-7 years old, I just walked out and I made my way to the beach and stayed in the beach for a bit so that I developed asthma at that time. Then I was taking, like, you know, they put me in a lot of medication and the doctor was like, you know, how severe the asthma was that most likely I wouldn't survive past like 11 years old. But I started playing sports. I started pushing through. My mom wouldn't allow me to just be a lazy kid. Pushing through that, and then growing up a bit older, I was in studying law. I was in law school in Egypt. And law school in Egypt, as you know, like it's after high school. So I had a college professor and he's like, the law that you study in, you got to memorize it for the test because most likely you'll never practice it. because Egypt was under martial law at that time, and he anticipated it would be under martial law for a long time, which he was correct. So Egypt was under martial law.
Wait. So you're learning civilian law, and it's like, you're going to be a lawyer, but here's the thing. You're never really going to practice this because we have a military dictatorship. So just, you know, take the exam and then go get a different job. Is that what I'm hearing?
And that's exactly what you hear. And this is coming from a college professor, used to be the Minister of Justice. So he was the Secretary of Justice, basically, before he was teaching in college. So a guy who knows what he's talking about. And he's like, so most likely you guys will not practice this because we're under emergency law and it's basically martial law and it's going to be there for a while. He was correct. Like I said, it was under emergency martial law from 1981 to 2011 when the Mubarak regime was ousted. So I left Egypt in the early 90s, like 91. I took off. It was right after Desert Storm. And I borrowed money from my mom for the ticket, borrowed $500 from my sister, hid the $500 in my shoes because I was terrified, took a flight, came to New York, and landed in New York in the summer of 91. And I'm like, okay, what do I do?
Let me put a pin in that for a second. So you're growing up in Alexandria, Egypt, which is kind of like, is it fair to say it's kind of a special city? Because it's not really, well, it's an Egyptian city, but it's also kind of, it was built by the Greeks, right? So it's—
correct.
It's got a little bit of a different flavor maybe than some other places in Egypt.
Absolutely. So Egypt, Alexandria, actually at that time, at the time I was growing up, we had more Greeks. We had Greeks, French, Italians. We had a few other nationalities. They were living there. So Egypt, because it's on the Mediterranean and Europeans loved it. And Egypt, before the military regime took over in 1952, used to be actually a very nice place with good economy. It was like really booming. So a lot of Europeans moved there, and when they moved, either they went to Cairo because they work in something government-related, but the majority of them went to Alexandria. So when you go there, actually, you'll see a lot more Roman artifacts than you will see Islamic artifacts or Arab artifacts. It's more European-style city. Or it used to be. Now it's like deteriorating just with the military not doing a good job. But yeah, you're absolutely right. So growing up there, you have the uniqueness of it's a port city. You see ships coming. You see Navy guys come in, commercial marines come in, they hang out in the city. So you end up seeing all of these foreigners who are coming. And I think what I've read once, like people who live on ocean or sea, or they are more attracted to travel because you grow up wanting to know what's on the other side of that, this big body of blue water, what's on the other side of it. So you always want to see. So the curiosity make a lot of people living in coastal cities, they travel, they leave. And I was one of those. So I ended up at age 20, I ended up leaving.
How did you see Islam change in Egypt when you were younger? Because I know it used to be this place, when you look at old photos of Egypt, it's like women in shorts and skirts dancing around. And but I've been to Egypt, of course, much later than that, in like the year 2000. There was no women walking around at all unless they were covered head to toe and often their face was covered. I mean, it was definitely not the black and white Egypt from photos.
Absolutely. And as you see like pictures from before, like from the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, and even when you see movies from that time, you'll see like actresses, like, you know, how they dress, you know, wearing mini skirts and all this. So ironically, by the way, when you look at pictures from Afghanistan in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, all the way till the 70s, was the same thing like Egypt. You see like girls going to college,
yeah,
like dress Westerner style, if that's a better way of saying it. Then what happened is when the military regime took over in the 50s, they played this nasty game where Arabs and Egyptians in particular are emotional and religion plays a big role in their life. So when the military took over, at that time, the Muslim Brotherhood were like moving. They were like, they started in that 1928. That's when the movement actually started, of the Muslim Brotherhood. So like fast forward, like, you know, 15, 16 years after, the military is about to take over and the military wanted to get the general population around them. So what do you do? You go and you find a movement that actually has some popularity, which is the Muslim Brotherhood. And they had like a marriage of convenience for a bit. Then after that, the military realized, okay, the Muslim Brotherhood are actually more popular than us. They risk in our ruling. So they took a lot of them, put them in jail, executed their leader. And then they were basically banned from like 1956, 1957, all the way to the 70s. To like 74, 75. Then Sadat came, but Sadat came after Nasser. Sadat was the president who did the peace accord with Israel. When Sadat came, now he's fighting, he had another enemy, which is like, you know, the Socialist Party, which was Nasser's party. They were very loyal to Nasser. They were very socialists. And he wanted to counter that. So how does he counter that? He takes the Muslim Brotherhood out of jail and he starts beefing the Muslim Brotherhood message. And even Sadat, who is my hero, but he made a few mistakes like anybody else. They used to call him the president, the leader, the believer leader. So he actually made himself like, you know, more conservative from a religious perspective, most likely than he was. But it was like, you know, a lot of leaders play those games. And so he did that and he took those guys out. And then we started seeing a lot more of that preaching of, hey, a woman should cover their hair, women should cover this. As a matter of fact, growing up, a woman wearing pants was not a good thing to do. Like they used to talk about this on like those people preaching. They used to talk about like, you know, if a woman is wearing pants, she's not conservative enough. She's not good. She's this, she's that. So we went from women wearing miniskirts and shorts to women wearing pants is wrong. And that kept going and going and going and kept the situation just kept getting worse and worse. Till when I was in college and the Muslim Brotherhood started, they started the grassroots movement way before Obama did. These guys started at in a way where they started preaching and talking to kids. So when I was, you know, 8, 9 years old, they used to like approach kids like my age and take us to the mosque and talk to us and like, you know, saluting the flag is haram, is forbidden. Doing arts in school, doing music is forbidden. And when they teach you that, when you learn this at that early age, that becomes engraved. Fortunately, my father kept me away from all of this. But you had other people who actually just went that route. And when they ended up going that route, that's how we ended up having. So the Muslim Brotherhood was the foundation that like Islamic Jihad was built on it. That was like Jama'at Islamiyya was branched out of the Muslim Brotherhood. Then after that, you have Al-Qaeda started out of that. So Ayman Zawahiri was member of the Muslim Brotherhood before that. Then fast forward, there was like a Nusra Front, which is basically was the beginning of ISIS. So it keeps getting like more radical and more radical and more radical. And then we don't know what's next.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Adam Gamal. We'll be right back. This episode is sponsored in part by AG1. It's important to me that supplements, stuff I put in my body, are high quality. I will not tell you to put anything in your body if I won't put it in mine. That's why for over a decade, I've been drinking AG1. It's unlike many supplement brands, AG1 conducts relentless testing to set the standard for purity and potency. A lot of friends ask me about vitamin drinks and whatnot. And I will say, look, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. Quality for AG1 is not a buzzword. My friend started the company a long time ago. They use high quality ingredients, industry leading manufacturing, rigorous testing. They go above and beyond industry standards. And I don't have to worry about drinking Chinese sawdust. It's tested for 950 contaminants and banned substances. And normally, if they test at all, they only test for like 10 things in other supplements, which, you know, maybe look into not taking those anymore. Taking care of your health should not be super complicated. And AG1 simplifies this by keeping low friction. You just throw a scoop in a bottle of water every morning. It's a little bit like that vegetable insurance, as my friend Tim Ferriss calls it. Every scoop includes prebiotics, probiotics, and digestive enzymes for gut support.
So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/Jordan. That's drinkag1.com/Jordan. And check it out.
This episode is also sponsored by SimpliSafe. Spring is here. What better way to soak in the season worry-free than with SimpliSafe watching our backs, dubbed the best home security system of 2024 by U.S. News & World Report and celebrated by Newsweek for top-notch customer service. SimpliSafe's got us covered. Imagine a safety net around your home, complete with sensors for break-ins, fires, floods, not to mention indoor and outdoor cameras for round-the-clock watch. Most security systems, break-ins, sure, fine, but like, floods, fires. That's the real shit, because that stuff could happen on a vacation or while you're gone for the day, and it could be way worse if somebody doesn't catch it. It's peace of mind on a whole new level, all for less than $1 a day for 24/7 professional monitoring, fast emergency dispatch when you need it. And the cool part is SimpliSafe pros can even chat up intruders, letting them know they've been spotted on camera and that help is on the way. And the cherry on top, no long-term contracts and a 60-day money-back guarantee.
SimpliSafe has given us and many of our listeners real peace of mind. We want you to have it too. Get 20% off your system today when you sign up for Fast Protect Monitoring at simplisafe.com/Jordan. That's simplysafe.com/Jordan. There's no safe like SimpliSafe.
If you're wondering how I manage to book all these great authors, thinkers, and creators every single week, it's because of my network, and I'm teaching you how to build your network for free over at 6MinuteNetworking.com. This course is all about improving your relationship-building skills and inspiring other people to want to develop a relationship with you. It is not cringy. It is very down-to-earth. It's not going to have a bunch of awkward or cheesy strategies or tactics. This is just practical exercises that'll make you a better connector, a better colleague, a better friend, and a better peer. In 6 minutes a day. That is really all it takes. And by the way, many of the guests on the show subscribe and contribute to this course. Come on and join us. You'll be in smart company where you belong. You can find the course at 6MinuteNetworking.com. Now, back to Adam Gamal. What span of time was this? I mean, how fast did everything go downhill? Because it sounds like once they kind of opened up the Muslim Brotherhood can of worms, women started covering up. You mentioned in the book there's like street imams that basically just preach super conservative Islam, regardless of how accurate it is. I'm asking because I feel like this stuff always happens much faster than people think, that authoritarian oppression comes at you pretty fast.
Yeah, I agree with you. So I think the whole thing, like, if I'm correct, like I said, growing up in the beginning, we used to have, so as a kid, I lived right by a major road, which is like one block away from the beach. So we used to have like an Easter, we used to have like these parades, and you would see like, you know, Mickey Mouse and the Easter Bunny and, you know, Santa Claus around Christmas. So I saw those things as a kid who was maybe 8, 9 years old. When I was like, you know, 12, 13 years old, so in the span of like, you know, 4 or 5 years, then those things went away. And then they said, well, the economy is bad. But it wasn't because of the economy, because those things were not, they were like mainly by companies and by people. So within 4 or 5 years, just people went and they start saying, this is haram and this is haram and this is haram. So it goes a lot faster than a lot of people think. And then if you want to add to that too, during that time, right, a bit after that, it was the Soviet Union-Afghan war. So during that time, again, the US, Egypt, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, they played this game of like, let's just push people to go fight the Soviet Union, which when you look at it as a, it's a good cause, but again, the way they took it and the way they pushed people to go, they start pushing. So I grew up seeing Mujahideen going to Afghanistan fighting for 5, 6 months and coming back. And when they came back, some people held them as heroes and some people looked at them as radical extremists that we don't want to deal with them. But all of these things were happening under the government's watch. Then how to motivate people to go fight in Afghanistan? You have these street imams that you're talking about and they'll go on cassette tapes back then and they'll preach and they'll say whatever. And these cassette tapes were like everywhere. I mean, like everywhere. They were giving them away for free. You don't have to buy them. They were like giving them away for free. And you can just, you ride a taxi, you can hear it in a taxi. You ride a, you go visit a friend, you can hear them playing it in their house. And the government allowed that to happen because for whatever reason, either it suits their agenda or they were so, I don't think they were that ignorant. But these guys start talking about like everything was forbidden, everything was haram. So it became so suffocating to the people there. And you'll see a lot of people left Egypt in the 60s and the 70s.
It almost sounds, it's weird because as a podcaster, it's like tapes making their way around and changing people's mind. It's like that's so grassroots, and but it's really hard to stop that kind of stuff, right? It's hard to stop people from sharing a cassette tape with a crazy message. It's wild how popular that stuff was because clearly that stuff struck an underlying nerve or chord, I should say, with the population. If you could hear it at your friend's house and in a taxi, it's like Joe Rogan kind of, only for terrorism. Really not ideal to have viral appeal like that, but it says something about the society. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. But here's the add to it too. How do you protect society from stuff like that? When you have a good education system that teaches you critical thinking and like how to analyze the information, how to actually take a piece of information and analyze it and critically think about it, then you can go and say, okay, a guy told me singing the national anthem is haram. I'm like, okay, he's an idiot. So you can go now, you can be the best podcaster and you can go and say, we should burn the US flag everywhere. Then people will be like, okay, man, Jordan went crazy. We're not going to listen to him anymore. Because people are educated enough to make this idea, right? Although we have people saying, yeah, Let's burn the flag.
Look, as somebody whose mission, the whole show is about critical thinking and helping people analyze information. Let me tell you, by the time the message of this show gets its shoes on, the crazy idea of burn the flag or become a terrorist has already made its way around the world 1,000 times, right? So, like, that's the problem, is us inoculating the population against nonsense ideas is a much harder process than distributing a nonsense idea in the first place. My audience would be 100 times larger if all I did was distribute nonsense ideas, because that stuff is so popular.
Correct.
Correcting misinformation, it's unfortunately much slower.
So yeah, so that's what I was saying. So at that time, so if you want to like combat this kind of thinking and people are educated enough, then they can actually listen. But in Egypt, the education system is like, you know, we tell you, it's built on giving you receive information, you memorize the information, we ask you in the test, what was the information? And you spit it out. But we don't teach you how to think or how to critically analyze and how to like digest and dissect information. It was very easy for these street imams to influence people. As a matter of fact, after the revolution in Egypt in 2011, there was an election, I think, in 2013. It was the Muslim Brotherhood and a former Air Force general. And the Muslim Brotherhood candidate went around mosques and he said, if you don't vote for me, you're going to hell. And some people actually believed the guy and voted for him. And sure. They said, well, this guy represents God. Again, that's what I was like preaching a lot in the book. And I'm not preaching, like trying to explain in the book is like, hey, when we give people the proper education, we all live a better life. Whether it's formal or informal education, you don't have to go to school to have education.
I agree. This is a good message. There's a story in the book about you running for, I think it was like student council, and the Muslim Brotherhood guys go in and they beat all you guys up, and then they file police reports that say that you beat them up. The illustration of this story is perfect because you go up to the guy and you go, why'd you beat us all up and then say that we beat you up? And he goes, it's okay to lie about things because we're at war. And it's like, oh, so you will literally just make stuff up, doesn't matter what it is, because you are right and everyone else is wrong. And you can't really fight an organization like that unless everybody's on the same page, because you have to know they're just going to lie. Everything they do is to take over power. There's no rules other than win.
Correct. So basically by any means necessary, right?
Right.
So I tell the guy, and the guy is like, well, and he credited to the prophet. And he said, well, the prophet said, we have 3 occasions we are authorized to lie during those 3 occasions. And one of them is war. And I'm like, so who you are at war with? And he's like, we're at war with everybody who does not believe what we believe. And these guys, they were so organized that they orchestrated the ass whipping during a day where there's a soccer game between the 2 major teams in Egypt. So nobody's in school because everybody watching the game. They give us a room to have a meeting on the 5th floor. So you cannot jump out of the window unless you're planning on killing yourself. And they put us in the end of the hallway. So these guys planned it. So it wasn't a random, let's just go beat them up. It was like, okay, we're going to have a plan. So we cannot underestimate their sick mind and go and say, well, and we have a lot of those guys in the U.S., by the way, and they've been in the U.S. since the 60s. And they have beliefs that they're not going to change unless, like I said this in the book, is like, you know, some grass, you can water it, and you change the color and you make it really green grass if you start early on with that grass. Some grass already is long and is like old or grown enough that you cannot change it. You just get to weed it out. And I'm not saying go kill people. I'm just saying that's how the GWAT was. Is like, you know, when there are people who are hopeless cases and you cannot just to try to convince them to change their minds. So we have to look at how these organizations, radical organizations, and not just Islamic radical organizations, honestly, any radical organizations, we have to look at how they recruit the people they join them. And we go and we say, how can we fix this? But if we just watch and wait for them to change their mind, that's not going to happen.
What made you want to come to the United States? Was it the idea that like, look, Egypt is full of these Muslim Brotherhood guys, the other side's a military dictatorship, there's no future here? Or was there something else going on?
It's mainly all the above plus, right? So, okay. Muslim Brotherhood were like, you know, moving faster than a lot of people thought. Although as a kid, I was seeing that. I wasn't a kid anymore. I mean, I was in college. So I can see that. Government was military dictatorship. So based on what's your last name, what family you came from, how rich or poor you are, you have no hope. what I was telling, I firmly believe this, I came to the U.S. to give me the right to dream. And what a lot of people don't, they take this for granted. The U.S. actually gives you the right to dream, that you can actually walk down the street and you say, you know, you see this house? One day I'm gonna buy this house. I'm gonna own a house like this. In Egypt, you don't have that option. You cannot go and say, well, here's a couple of million dollar house. I'm gonna work my ass off till I buy it. So you don't have that option there. It's either you're poor or you're rich, and where you were born and how you were born and what family. And you can have one of two exceptions, but even the exceptions that of successful people in Egypt, they left Egypt. Like, you know, some of the best doctors in the world are Egyptians. They left Egypt. One of the best soccer players in the world, everybody knows him, Mo Salah in Liverpool, he left Egypt. Nobel Prize winners who originally from Egypt, they won it when they were in the U.S. So it's seeking better opportunities and seeking a land where you have the right to dream.
Speaking of dreams, tell me about your first night in New York City, because that was more of a nightmare, I think.
It's a good way. I was going to tell you, so it wasn't a dream. So I landed in New York, but literally, I mean, I had a booklet. They give it to you as an international student. You have a booklet that has all the economic places to stay at. I had the addresses of all the YMCAs.
Oh, yeah.
One of them was in New York City. And I get off the plane in New York and I try to talk to the bus driver who I don't understand what he's saying. He was nice enough to like, okay, dude, just sit here. Took the booklet from me after asking him 10 times. And it was his way of like, dude, stop fucking asking me questions. When your stop comes, I'll lay you out.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, like YMCA. All right, just sit here. I'll tell you when to get on the bus.
Exactly.
Yeah. Just stop talking and then we'll be okay.
Yeah. So I get on the subway. We get off. I had a friend. He was traveling with me. Me not speaking English, I knew English more than he did. So it was like, you know, a clown show. Couldn't make it out of the subway station to go up. It was a Sunday. Finally, a police officer, after asking him a few times, took me by the hand and took me out. And he's like, here's the street. So it is raining. And I'm like, dude, it doesn't rain in Egypt in July. I mean, it's raining in the summer. We had a suitcase. I have my $500 hidden in my shoes. Well, I bought like, you know, the subway ticket. I think it was like $1.25 at that time. So I have whatever left from the five. So I'm hiding the money in my shoes. I'm terrified. I see the police officer is like, he pointed the YMCA. We go there. And I had a phone number of a friend. He was in the Boy Scouts in Egypt with me. His mom gave me his phone number. And she's like, he's in the U.S. He's been in the U.S. for, I wanted to say it was a year or two before me. I get coins and I'm dialing his number from a pay phone in the YMCA. There is a community bathroom in the YMCA, the paid phone by the community bathroom. So I go and I dial the number. And what his mom didn't do is she didn't put one plus one before the area code.
Oh, she didn't dial one before the area code, right? Okay.
She didn't write it.
Or she didn't write the one.
Right. I'm dialing without the one. It doesn't go through. I kept doing that till like about 2 o'clock in the morning. Finally, there is a junkie standing by the bathroom. I think he got sick and tired again of seeing me. The guy went to smoke his joint and he's like, this foreign kid coming. So he took the number. He took the quarter. Put it there and dial the number for me. Finally, my friend answered. I told him where I'm at. He's like, go back to your room, move your bunk bed behind the door so nobody can break into your room, and don't leave. Don't get out of the room till I come and pick you up tomorrow. So my buddy's in the room. I go back to the room. We push the bunk bed behind the door. I take the $500. I put him under the insole of the shoes and I put my socks there. And I'm like, okay, if somebody comes to the room, they wouldn't be able to find the money. So I was really terrified. I mean, because when I landed there too, I had just seen Pretty Woman, Julia Roberts and Richard Gere. I was like, dude, what happened to the limos? What happened to Julia Roberts? I mean, what happened to all the pretty women that I'm going to see in the streets and the limos and, you know, like well-dressed men? And there was none of that, by the way. None of that. So I was like,
yeah, they're not at the YMCA in Harlem at 4 o'clock in the morning.
And I was like, did I land in the wrong country? So next morning, we ended up going to New Jersey, and the journey started from there.
That's so funny. My friend is also Egyptian and grew up, and his whole family's in New Jersey. I don't know how big the Egyptian community is there, but there's a distinct possibility that you are either related to or know somebody from my friend's family, unless there's just a zillion Egyptian people
there are
in New Jersey, which is also possible.
It's a huge Egyptian community, and I have no idea. And when I came, and everybody was like, hey, man, when you go, there is a mosque in Jersey City. Just go there and you'll find people that you know. and you'll meet them. And then they'll tell you where to go to school, where to live, where to get a job. So I don't know why Jersey City, but everybody comes to Jersey City. The fortunate one, the lucky ones, they go there as a stop and they leave. I think the unfortunate ones, or the unlucky ones, they ended up going and staying. I was lucky. I went there for a bit and I left.
Trapped in New Jersey, the American nightmare. Yeah, no, it's probably not that bad.
It's not. It's not.
New Jersey's the butt of every joke, as you know. It's really not that bad of a place.
I know.
We need something to kick, I guess. I don't know. It's like, poor New Jersey.
When I tell people like I lived in New Jersey, like, which exit? I'm like 14A. So, but what I didn't tell you too, like, who did I meet in the mosque? So I met the blind sheikh, the guy who was behind the World Trade Center.
Oh, the bombing, you mean, the blind sheikh. So tell us a little bit about who this guy was.
So this guy was originally, most likely, was one of the Muslim Brotherhood guy, advanced a bit to whatever came like Jama'a Islamiyah, like came after the Muslim Brotherhood. And he was the guy who issued the fatwa for killing Sadat.
The president of Egypt.
The president of Egypt at that time. And he said because Sadat did the peace agreement with Israel, it's okay to kill him. Because whatever, he came up with some, like any of the other crazy imams. So he came up with this and he's like, so he ended up being prosecuted. And I don't know if he spent time in jail or he came out. But then after that, he was helping, pushing people to Afghanistan with the war against the Soviet Union. And then, according to public record, a few years after, CIA helped him, issued him a visa from the U.S. embassy in Sudan, and he ended up in the U.S. He ended up in Jersey City, in the mosque. So here I am, I walk there, and maybe my second or third month I'm in the U.S., I walk there and I see him, and I hear people saying, you know, Sheikh Omar is here, Sheikh Omar is here. His name is Omar Abdurrahman, and we called him the blind sheikh. He wasn't doing sermons or anything. I mean, he was just, he would go pray. I think he was married to an American Muslim lady to get his green card or whatever. But he would sit down, and after Friday prayer, he would sit down and people would sit around him and ask him religious questions. Like, you want to ask a priest, like, is gambling okay or not in religion? So one time, I'm a curious kid, and I said, I'm like, I want to hear what these people are talking about. Those are the people who beat the fuck out of me in Egypt, and here I come to the U.S., and they are here still. I mean, what the fuck?
Yeah.
I sit down, and I'm like, let me see what they're saying and what kind of crazy stuff they're talking about. I think the second question that somebody asked him was like, is oral sex allowed in Islam or not? So these guys who've been studying religion for God knows how long, and, you know, they come into a Friday prayer, and they sit down, and they're going to talk about, like, you know, how they're going to solve the world's problem, and what they're going to ask the guy is like, you know, is oral sex allowed or not?
Yeah. I mean, so I'm like, dudes be dudes at the end of the day, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, I'm sitting in the wrong crowd, and got up and left. And if people are interested, what he said is, he said it's allowed. So if people are curious.
Yeah. But it's like, you think like, oh, I'm going to ask this guy, like, why did God put us on earth? And it's yeah. like, hey, can I get BJs or what?
Like, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, you and I, like I said,
deep thinker.
He was the guy with, like, you know, the big thinker, the scholar, the guy who's been studying
yeah.
religion forever. I'm going to ask him, like, how could I be a good human being? Or like, why God put us on earth? Or
right.
tell me the history of this religion or that religion. But no, that the question was literally that. And I was like, okay, fuck yeah. all of you guys. I'm leaving.
Yeah. Well, it also shows you like the level of thought people put into. They're like, I'm going to die for my religion. What do you know about it? I just know that I'm allowed to, you know, get oral yeah. sex. And what's the history? I didn't ask any of those questions. I didn't ask any of the big, like, those other questions. It's just like, this is the stuff that's important to guys who are in their early 20s or whatever, who are
yeah.
the ones that they're recruiting into this extreme version
yep.
of religion. It's just, it's insane. It's literally insane and a waste of air. How was immigrant life, though, in the first few years? I mean, you talk about having dentistry done basically in some guy's house, people ripping you off at work, playing chess in the park for money. I mean, that's quite a grind.
So what a lot of people don't realize is, like, you know, the majority of immigrants, legal immigrants, so I don't want people to get all bent out of shape, but immigrants, when they come in because they are seeking a better life. And they'll do whatever it takes. They'll work hard, they'll study hard, they'll grind. So first 3 months, actually, I'm sleeping on the floor and not like having a mattress on the floor. No, sleeping on the floor. I didn't have money. I barely got a job. I'm going taking English classes in the evening to learn English. I'm working in a factory that the guys were like Lebanese. Again, nothing against Lebanese people, but these guys decided not to pay me after like, you know, 3-4 months. And you're like, okay, now I don't have money. What am I going to do? Found a mattress in the trash, took a mattress from the trash, put it in the room. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to bring a blanket and just put it on and sleep on it. This is part of it. And you like, you know, you work in gas stations, you do whatever it takes, because whatever you have here at that time, still better than your home country. You still, you know, you went and you worked and now I can go to school. Now I can learn English. Now I can maybe learn more than English. Maybe I can get a college degree better than what I was going to have from there. And then I didn't even know how to drive. So I've learned how to drive with all of these different jobs. And then finally I found a job with a guy, his name is Jim, and he's Jewish American Israeli, like originally from Israel. So he and I could not be any different. I'm from Egypt,
right.
Arab Muslim, he's Jewish, Israeli, American. But we both had the same common goal, like, you know, looking for a better life and looking for how to make America home. So it didn't take us a week to click, to like, you know, we had the same ideas, we had the same common goals, we had the same opinions. You do that and you do that a bit and then you're like, okay, how do I make this home? How do I make this country really home? It's not cliche. I'm not trying to recruit people to join the army. But I was like, here is a key actually can get you to be as American as anybody can argue with you. And it was joining the military. And I felt like it's a debt that I owed the country I'm going to make home. And I decided to join the military. But during that time, whether the things that people take for granted, just the right to dream, or even understanding the immigrant community, like we were to save money. If you come in from Egypt, it was cheaper to buy a ticket from Egypt round trip. So when we would go to Egypt, we'll take one-way ticket, come back, have a round-trip ticket. But then at that time, the airline was the only face that you see when you get in on a flight for an international flight. Like you came from Egypt, I would buy your ticket from you and pay you, you know, some money and you give me your ticket and I'll fly to Egypt on a ticket that it says Jordan on it. And nobody knew that. So those are the things that I'm talking about. Like immigrants, they knew the ins and outs of those things. They knew like who's faking a driver's license somewhere in Brooklyn, who's getting people to marry for green card. Immigrants knew those things. So it's a valuable resource for us to just ignore them and say, well, you know, you just arrived, you know, two generations before you and my family came in Ellis Island and they took the keys with them and they locked the door and nobody else can come behind. No, it's still a country of immigrants. And if you don't bring them in and have them part of society, they're going to become part of, again, a society. And you don't want that.
This is the Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Adam Gamal. We'll be right back. This episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show is brought to you by Nissan. Ever wondered what's around that next corner or what happens when you push further? Nissan SUVs have the capabilities to take your adventure to the next level. As my listeners know, I get a lot of joy on this show talking about what's next. Dreaming big, pushing yourself further. That's why I'm excited once again to partner with Nissan, because Nissan celebrates adventurers everywhere. Whether that next adventure for you is a cross-country road trip or just driving yourself 10 minutes down the road to try that local rock climbing gym, Nissan is there to support you as you chase your dreams. So take a Nissan Rogue, Nissan Pathfinder, or Nissan Armada and go find your next big adventure. With the 2024 Nissan Rogue, the class-exclusive Google built-in is your always-updating assistant to call on for almost anything. No need to connect your phone, as Google Assistant, Google Maps, and Google Play Store are built right into the 12.3-inch HD touchscreen infotainment system of the 2024 Nissan Rogue. So thanks again to Nissan for sponsoring this episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show and for the reminder to find your next big adventure and enjoy the ride along the way. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. This episode is also sponsored by Progressive. Let's face it, sometimes multitasking can be overwhelming, like when your favorite podcast is playing, the person next to you is talking, and your car fan is blasting, all while you're trying to find the perfect parking spot. But then again, sometimes multitasking is easy, like quoting with Progressive Insurance. They do the hard work of comparing rates so you can find a great rate that works for you, even if it's not with them. Give their comparison tool a try, and you might just find getting the rate and coverage you deserve is easy. All you need to do is visit Progressive's website to get a quote with all the coverage you want, like comprehensive and collision coverage or personal injury protection. Then you'll see Progressive's direct rate and their tool provide options from other companies all lined up and ready to compare, so it's simple to choose the rate and coverage you like. Press play on comparing auto rates. Quote at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. If you like this episode of the show, I invite you to do what other smart and considerate listeners do, which is take a moment and support our amazing sponsors. All of the deals, the discount codes, the ways to support the show are all searchable and clickable over at jordanharbinger.com/deals. If you can't remember the name of a sponsor, you can't find a code, you're wondering if we even have that sponsor, just email me, jordan@jordanharbinger.com. I am more than happy to surface that code for you. It is that important that you support those who support the show. Now for the rest of part one with Adam Gamal. It's interesting. You highlight the idea that the American dream is the right to dream, whereas in Egypt under the Muslim Brotherhood, you don't have the right to dream. You're not supposed to do anything like that. It's not really a part of the culture, which is, it's hard to wrap your head around that as an American. Like, wait, you don't want upward mobility if it's not somebody who's in our organization that believes what we believe? I mean, that is such a toxic thing to grow up with, because basically you're forcing all your best people to join this weird militant organization where they're focused on totally different things. So of course people leave if they have potential and the ability to do so and go literally anywhere else. Well, maybe not literally anywhere else, but certainly to a free country like the United States, a relatively free country like the United States. So you join the military. How many Egyptian immigrants with shaky English are in basic training with you at that point? I would imagine it's a lonely journey in the beginning.
I was the only guy.
So, yeah, I bet.
I was totally the only guy. For people who know me in person, a lot of Egyptians look like Mexicans or Puerto Ricans. So everybody spoke to me in Spanish because everybody thought I was Puerto Rican, because nobody like even fathomed like the idea of having an Egyptian guy in the army. So yeah, I was the only guy. In basic training, I was the only guy. In advanced training, I was the only guy. Well, I'll tell you, actually, the first Egyptian I met in Fort Hood, Texas, was on his way out of the army. He was an older guy, spent 4 years in the army, and he was leaving the army at that time. I think he was a tanker. But no, there wasn't that many Arabs in general. I think as a military, we were not doing a good job in recruiting in those immigrant communities. And then at the same time, the immigrant community, the Arab American immigrant community, were not doing a good job adapting. Like some immigrants, whether Arabs or non-Arab, some immigrants, when they arrive to the U.S., they have achieved their goal. Their goal was to arrive. And they stop there. And that's it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, that's the beginning of the journey. You just arrived to the beginning of the journey. That's one point I'm trying to put a lot of emphasis on the book and in my interviews, to speak to the immigrant community. Don't settle for the status quo. I mean, you came to this country to make it home, to make the best out of your life. So go to school, join the military, go work hard, start a business, do something other than just saying, I'm going to come and stay in this. So like you and I talked a few minutes ago, but it must be like a gazillion Egyptians in Jersey, because they come and they stay. Well, you have like another 49 states. You can actually travel, go to different states, buy a farm, or like go farm somewhere, or go cow tipping in Wisconsin, or go do something else, like explore America.
The peak of American life.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's funny. I understand that. It's true though. People do. They stay and they get settled. But that's also like very much human nature. You know, like my grandparents were immigrants. One of my grandparents, I should say, was an immigrant. The other ones were also already had been born in Detroit, but their parents had immigrated to Detroit. And then my parents stayed in Detroit. And then I moved. And then suddenly my cousins started moving. And I was like, oh, you know, it's funny that you ended up moving to California. A bunch of my cousins told me, oh, I never would have left Michigan, but then you left.
Yep.
And then I left, and then Christina left, and then Steve left. And it's like, oh, you guys left because I left? And they're like, yeah, we saw you moved, and then you were living like a different life, and you didn't move back home after 5 months. So we moved, and we realized we like it better over here. You really do need to see somebody break the mold. It's tough, though. And that's kind of like what you're doing, right? Like, you broke the mold, joined the military, moved to a different place. And you're showing other immigrants like, hey, you don't have to just stay in, you know, New Jersey or Dearborn, Michigan or Cupertino, California, or wherever your family moves to. Arcadia, I guess, for the Chinese, a lot of the Chinese, or Vancouver, right? There's a lot of places you can go. I would imagine, though, if you're like the only Arab that you even knew in the military, surely you're dealing with some racism at that point in time, just because, you know, you're talking about joining a military full of people who are fighting other people that look like you, not necessarily being on the same team.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to go back to your point about people not moving. It's exactly what's in the book, Who Moved My Cheese? I was the first mice who just decided, you know what? I'm not going to say who moved my cheese. I'm going to go out and find more cheese. So I found a lot more cheese. But to go back to Yeah. So when you join the military and you're not white, you're not black, you're not Puerto Rican, or you're not Hispanic, you must be the enemy. That's just how the equation goes, right? You must be the enemy. And it was right after Desert Storm. So my second day of basic training, the drill sergeant, they set you in the floor. It's like a big hall. They set you in the floor. They trying to break the ice. The drill sergeant goes around and he's like, you know, every one of you guys tell me your name, where are you from, and why did you join the army? And you have the guy from Hawaii. He's like, you know, I'm from Hawaii. My name is John Smith, and I joined the army because I want a better education. Or I joined the army because I want to serve my country. I want to pay for college. I have student loans. So you have all of these different reasons. I didn't get to tell the guy my reason. I said, you know, my name is Adam Gamal. I'm from Egypt. And the guy was like, well, hold on. Before I even told them why I joined the army, and he's like, where are you from again? I said, I'm from Egypt. He's like, didn't we fucking kill all of you Arabs in Desert Storm?
Oof.
I said, as a matter of fact, no, you have one left who's sitting here.
Oh my gosh, what a horrible thing to say, though. I mean, so ignorant and gross.
And let me add to this, that drill sergeant's last name, because it's a very common last name, was Vasquez.
Mm.
So you can imagine.
Vasquez.
What national. Exactly. So I'm like,
yeah,
this is coming from a brown guy just like me.
Yeah.
My battle buddy was from Pennsylvania. A blonde kid with blue eyes, one of the nicest guys. Right after that, I mean, we walk back to our, like, as we walk into our bunk beds, and the guy's like, hey, man, don't let something like that bother you. So I tell people, for every person that you meet who's either ignorant or, I didn't want to say the guy was racist because I don't think he was racist. I just think he was ignorant. But for every person that you meet who's ignorant, there are at least maybe 99 who are good-hearted, kind people. Who are willing to just show you the rope and take you with them and the way. And like I said, a lot of things I mentioned in the book, like about that guy is like, you know, the last day in basic training, when we'd spend time with his family. I go to Fort Hood, Texas. My first platoon sergeant is a great guy who is like, you know, taking me under his wing, literally like take me under his arm. And he's like, and I'm short, so it's easy for him to take me under his arm. And he shows me, he teaches me those things. So for every, like, I don't want people to be scared, like, oh, the military is like full of racist people, because it's not. But I did encounter those, and I want this to be more positive and more encouraging and like inspiring. So this is not about me complaining about somebody being racist in the military, because we have racist people in Egypt too. So we have them everywhere.
That's true. I just thought it was, you're the only guy there. Surely that must have happened. Tell us what we can learn about the unit. I know it's tough because you can't even mention the name, and it's like, there's no other books about this unit. It started in 1981. No one other than you has really written about this, correct? It's basically still totally secret.
So correct. So we have journalists who did like, you know, investigative journalism, and they got like, you know, they sat in a bar, got some information from, I'm the first actual operative or operator that was member in the unit that wrote a book about his life and about the unit. So it was a very hard balance to tell a story and at the same time protect national security. It's an organization it's a mix of a special operation and intel. So imagine that you take Delta and CIA and you put them together and NSA and you put the three of them together and you come up with a guy who's capable of being one of the three. So that's the objective of the unit, was created after the Iran hostage situation. And that was like at that time, okay, we have door kickers. And I'm not going to say like it's easy to become a Delta guy or a Navy or like a SEAL Team 6 guy. It's still hard, but it's a lot more physical. So like, you know, go to the gym 20 hours a day, get muscle memories and how to shoot. You're going to pick it up. Then the more you shoot, the more calm you are when you shoot. You can train what we call hard skills. When you go to soft skills, how to blend in, how to be the gray guy, how to be the guy who's not going to sit and talk about, let me tell you how many times I jumped out of an aircraft and let me tell you how cool I am and let me just show you how you want to go to the gun show. Let me show you the guns.
Mm-hmm.
But for us as an organization, we were a bit different, mentally different. We were more, I don't want to say we were more intellectual, but we were more like thinkers. We more want to solve problems. You give us a problem, we'll put our brain behind it and we'll sit and think about it and do it. And then it's made of, you know, like men and women, and I call them like, you know, shadow warriors who nobody knows anything about them. I wanted people to know like there is an organization that, and we got approval from DOD. Just went through all the process. It sat with DOD for 13 months, the book. They took some stuff out. They changed some stuff to protect sources and methods. So the book went to DOD in August in 2021. So literally almost 3 years ago. This is when it first went for review and it sat with them till 2022. Late 2022 is then when we got it and we talked about it. But the organization itself, I cannot obviously say the location, but when I was there, we had people deploying in over like 20 plus countries in war zones, non-war zones, working out of embassies, not working out of embassies. But we were going after like the real, real, real bad guys. And our main job was not to kill them. Our main job was to find them and fix them. Fix them is like, I did like the story that we talked about in the first of the book is this guy was been tracking him for a few years. Now we know exactly where he's at. Fix him is like, okay, he's going to be in this location for a few days, a few weeks or whatever for us to be able to execute the target. That's the unit. Our selection process is not classified. But to maintain the integrity of it, I didn't talk about selection or training.
Mm-hmm.
Part of our training obviously is classified. Another part is like, you know, how to do land navigation, how to do defensive driving, how to shoot, how to jump out of an airplane. Those are common things like for special operation guys.
I was like, wait a minute, this training, there's a lot of gaps, but it makes sense that they had to remove a lot of that stuff. It is sort of clear though that brain power is part of the focus. And I know people idolize SEALs because of their super impressive physical and mental training. But I always figured, and I wish I'd known this when I was younger because I may have actually stayed and joined the military instead of leaving the reserves. I figured there had to be room for people who can speak multiple languages, blend in with various cultures, develop relationships at a really expert level, but maybe can't, I don't know, like swim 5 miles in the ocean while carrying a cinder block or whatever. Like that stuff is amazing. But whenever I saw that, I was like, well, I can't do that. All I can do is learn languages to fluency very quickly and connect with people really easily and get them to tell me things that they don't normally talk about. Like that, I was like, but there's no real use for that. The State Department was interested in that stuff, of course, and other organizations were interested in that stuff. But the military was like, we need nuclear engineers. And I was like, all right. This is not the crew for me. That you either need to be able to swim 5 miles in the ocean without a wetsuit carrying a cinder block, or you need to be able to be a nuclear engineer. So I left for that reason.
So the thing is for us too, we're the guys who are swimming and they throw things in the bottom of the pool. We did some of these things, not absolutely not to the extent like the Navy SEALs do. I think a lot of people love the Navy SEALs because the Navy SEALs love to write books. Oh, people know them very well.
Yeah, that's part of it.
That's
sure.
But guys, I have a lot of friends. Like Navy SEALs, and I have a lot of friends from Delta. I have a lot of friends from CIA and NSA, and they are all great Americans. It's just everybody brings his own strength to the table. We couldn't do it by ourselves. We couldn't do it without having other guys with us. For them, it's the same thing. They couldn't do it without having other people around them. So it's a good ecosystem in the Joint Special Operations Command, and especially when we partnered a lot with the CIA and NSA, we were able to execute targets a lot better. But you're absolutely right. Having people with like, you know, the language capability, the cultural capability, the people who are like, what you're doing now is like you get people to talk, right? And you get them to tell you stories that most likely they wouldn't say it somewhere else. Having that capability, being a good listener, being attentive to, even in business now, like for me, understanding when to shake somebody's hand, understanding when, how to treat an older guy who's older than you. And I've seen it, like I've seen it in Iraq, I've seen it in Afghanistan, when you see like a young captain who's 23, 24 years old, Captain America, he feels he's better than everybody else in the world. And he sits with a 70-year-old tribal leader in Afghanistan, and he just sits and he crosses his legs and he has the bottom of his shoe in the face of the older man. Well, in a lot of cultures, that's not a good thing. So you do that, and then you, right there, you just lost an ally. You just lost the guy who could have been your ally. What I tell people, like understanding culture, it's like the commas and the periods of the English language. The commas and the periods are too small, but they change the meaning. It could be a question, it could be a sentence, it could be the end of a sentence. You not knowing the culture is basically you just have a sentence running without any commas, periods, question marks, just the sentence is going. And then you're going with it. So I tell people just those small things in the culture have a lot of meaning and people should understand it. And I was promoting that when I was in the military, like, guys, we need to learn these things, not just the language. We need to learn those things because we can win hearts and minds a lot faster than just going talking down to an older man.
You know, the punctuation analogy is really good. It makes a lot of sense. There's a saying in English that I'm sure you've heard, which is punctuation is the difference between helping your Uncle Jack off a horse and helping your Uncle Jack off a horse.
Yep.
And I'll let that one sit there for people who need a minute.
I've heard that one.
Hey, it's not mine, so feel free to go ahead and throw that, sprinkle that in your media tour.
Yeah, I will.
But
let me take a note.
Yes, yeah, write that down. Only the important stuff. What types of missions, you sort of touched on this a little bit, but what types of missions was the unit involved in? I mean, one, in the book, you mentioned finding kidnapped generals. Like, when I heard that, I was like, wow, how often does that happen? That seems like something that should probably never be allowed to happen.
Yeah, so the unit is involved in missions where, so we were basically getting our tasks from, like, Secretary of Defense level. Three main missions, JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command, in charge of three main missions: counter-narcotic, counter-terrorism, and hostage rescue. Those are the three main missions. Counter-insurgency is something that came up after, and I'm just still trying to understand what the fuck is counter-insurgency. Mm-hmm. But it's something like some general came up with it, and it sounded cool. But those are the three main things. So whether it's a counter-narcotic, like killing Pablo Escobar, counter-terrorism, the bin Ladens and the guys I talked about, and Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, and you name it. And all the way from, I'm from Egypt, so I can say this, all the way from bumfuck Egypt to the other bumfuck Egypt.
Right.
So from anywhere, I deploy to places. So I'll say the name of this city just because it sounds really cool and it's not classified that people were there. But the name of the city is Ouagadougou.
Mm.
So for your listeners, they can Google it and figure out where the fuck is Ouagadougou.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I've heard of it before, but now I'm like, where is Ouagadougou again? Is it Ghana? No, it's Burkina Faso. Is it Burkina Faso?
Yeah, Burkina Faso.
Someplace with a military dictatorship.
Yeah, Burkina Faso. And then you can be, maybe you'll end up in Timbuktu, or you end up in bumfuck Egypt.
In Mali.
So you can be...
Which also has a military dictatorship right now, which aligned with Burkina Faso, I guess, coincidentally.
And the one thing with a lot of these places that has a military dictatorship, while they have the military dictatorship, the environment is ripe for extremist groups, because those extremist groups, sometimes they partner with the military, they don't partner with the military, they go against the military. And then, yeah, there is a lot in the Sahara region, in West Africa, going all the way to the Sub-Sahara, there is a lot of smugglers. So they smuggle weapons, they smuggle, and if you are a smuggler, you can smuggle terrorists as well. And then the smugglers are just, their main goal in life is to make money. The unit or other joint special operation units, they go to these areas to track down bad guys who are being smuggled through, and you never knew, like the underwear bomber was from Nigeria.
Yeah.
And then they make it all the way to East Africa, to Somalia. From Somalia, they can cross the Bab el-Mandeb Strait to make it to the Arabian Gulf, and they can make it up. So it's connected, and they can travel around. So General McChrystal, one of the greatest generals in our recent time, is like, he used to tell us all the time, it takes a network to defeat a network. If we're not operating as a network, so basically you have to, if your enemy speaks Chinese, you need to understand Chinese. If your enemy speaks network, you need to understand network. So that's why we were everywhere. So we were deployed to a lot of different locations. I deployed more than 12 times in the 10 years I was there. After that, I left and I went to another organization, was doing something else. And then I retired in 2016. But the unit itself, so those three things, the counter-narcotic, hostage rescue, and counter-terrorism, that's why that, okay, there is a general got kidnapped. Or when I was in Iraq, I was leaving Iraq, coming back to the US. I made it to Qatar. The unit commander contacted me, is like, hey, there is a hostage situation in a kidnapped soldier in Iraq. We need you to go back. So I had to call my wife and say, hey, I'm sorry, I'm not coming. I have to go back. And those are the things that a lot of people don't realize how hard on any family those things are. So people are like, oh, military guys are really cool and they deploy and like special operation guys and they get paid more and they jump out of aircrafts. And no, but to call your wife the day you're supposed to arrive back home and you tell her you're not coming, dude, they need some balls.
You're about to hear a preview of the Jordan Harbinger Show with the go-to person to help negotiate a hostage situation in Syria when no other intelligence agency would help.
When you have a hostage negotiation, especially in a war zone, the hardest thing to do is to actually figure out who the hostage takers are. And the rumors are off the charts. Proof of life is getting that authentication, that you're talking with the people who actually have the person. And you want to know, of course, that the person's still alive. You ask them for some question or some nickname, something that no one would be able to know. And if they can't come back with that answer, you walk away. The person I had to flag down and find who held this Westerner hostage was probably the biggest Captagon dealer in the country. And they often use the same distribution routes for the Captagon as they do for human trafficking. So the same people who take little girls from villages and send them to the Gulf, to Dubai, to Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, to other places there, they fill also stomachs of the girls with drugs and use them as couriers while also shipping them as the product itself. The first thing you have to do is tell the parents to stop doing something that they want to do and that every schmuck under the sun is telling them to do, which is to seek public support, right? To get public statements, to do Facebook campaigns. The Secretary of State say how we're not going to leave a stone unturned until this awful act is being brought to justice. What just happens with that is your price went up before you even started a negotiation. You do not want to drive up the perceived value of the hostage. Sometimes people are taken hostage just for the shock value of executing them. What you're going to do with the campaign that you're doing right now is going to get your child or your spouse killed. How is pissing off the people who hold that person's life in their hands helping you? By the time I get involved, it's usually too late.
To learn all about the nuances of negotiating with criminals and human traffickers, check out episode 617 of The Jordan Harbinger Show.
All right, that's it for part one. Part two coming soon might already be out, depending on when you hear this. All things Adam Gamal will be in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com. I got to admit, there's not a whole lot. It's not even really his name. You can also ask the AI chatbot on the website. Transcripts in the show notes, advertisers, deals, discount codes, ways to support the show, all at jordanharbinger.com/deals. Please consider supporting those who support the show. We've also got our newsletter where every week the team and I dig into an older episode of the show. We dissect the lessons from it. So if you're a fan of the show, you want a recap of highlights, takeaways, or you just want to know what to listen to next, the newsletter is a great place to do just that. Gabriel and I are refreshing the format as well. I'm looking forward to hearing your feedback on that. JordanHarbinger.com/news is where you can find it. Don't forget about 6-Minute Networking as well. It's over at 6MinuteNetworking.com. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on Twitter and Instagram. You can also connect with me on LinkedIn. This show is created in association with Podcast One. My team is Jen Harbinger, Jace Sanderson, Robert Fogarty, and Gabriel Mizrahi. Remember, we rise by lifting others. The fee for this show is you share it with friends when you find something useful or interesting. The greatest compliment you can give us is to share the show with those you care about. So if you know somebody's into this like military stuff, the intelligence stuff, special forces stuff, definitely share this episode with them. Maybe you want to share it with somebody who's recently moved to the United States and is feeling a little bit foreign. This is an immigrant who really assimilated and really made it here in the States. Share this episode with them too. In the meantime, I hope you apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you learn. And we'll see you next time. Thanks again to Nissan for sponsoring this episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
Hey, buddy.
Hey, buddy.
What's going on, man?
Hi, guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, the team, Loveline, man. You guys remember us from back in the day? Well, we're doing a pod, and we're doing it every day.
And we've been doing it for a while, and if I hear one more time people saying, God, I loved you and Adam together on Loveline, and I'm like, yeah, we're doing a podcast. Will you please just join us at the Adam and Dr. Drew Show, please?
Right.
At adamanddrdrewshow.com. It's a great show. Come on now. Only on Podcast One. That's us, Adam and Dr. Drew Show. Just like the old days.
Doctor's orders.
Oh, man, you're funny.
Yep. All right. Let's go save some babies.
Let's do it.